Today on Against the Grain, what happens to survivors of violence who defend themselves against their attackers, often intimates? According to legal scholar Lee Goodmark, it often depends on whether those survivors look suitably victim-like. She discusses the circumstances that frequently lead to the criminalization of survivors of violence and makes the case for the abolition of a punitive legal system. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the 1970s, feminists organized against an unresponsive criminal legal system when women faced intimate partner violence, rape, and sexual assault. And since then, significant reforms have taken place within the legal system, with far-reaching consequences for victims and perpetrators alike. Lee Goodmark delves into those consequences in her latest book, Imperfect Victims, Criminalized Survivors, and the Promise of Abolition Feminism, published by UC Press. She's the Marjorie Cook Professor of Law and Director of the Gender Violence Clinic at the University of Maryland School of Law. Over the last 40 years, anti-violence advocates have demanded greater punishment for gender-based violence in the criminal legal system. Lee, what has been the outcome of that approach?
There have been a number of outcomes of that approach. One is to make policymakers feel that we've done something constructive about intimate partner violence, when in fact, the criminal legal response does very little to deter or decrease intimate partner violence. That's something that I talked about in my last book called Decriminalizing Domestic Violence. But one of the really serious consequences of criminalization has been the increased criminalization of people subjected to intimate partner violence. Some people that we call criminalized survivors, people who've been convicted of crimes related to their own victimization. And you'll note that I don't call it an unintended consequence at this point, because we've known about it for far too long at this point to call it unintended. It's simply a consequence that we've come to accept.
Take us back to, for a moment anyway, the 1970s, when on the one hand, there was an increased awareness of, well, gender-based violence, intimate partner violence, often in the context of second wave feminism. And then at the same time, some high profile cases of women who killed their attackers or victimizers and then were prosecuted for it. Can you describe that moment? Because in many ways, a lot of what has happened since comes out of that moment, both in terms of how we on the left often think about gender-based violence and also how the state has responded to it.
So by the late 1960s, early 1970s, it's fair to say that law enforcement was fairly non-interventionist in terms of gender-based violence. And if you look at, for example, the police training manuals of the time, you'll see instructions to police officers not to make arrests in cases of intimate partner violence, but rather to try to defuse the violence in some ways. The urban myth language of take a walk around the block actually appeared in some of the police training manuals of the time. And so anti-violence feminists looked at this non-intervention and decided that it was the failure of law enforcement to take gender violence seriously, to treat it like any other crime, that was responsible for high rates of gender-based violence, and started to advocate strongly for police to intervene, to make arrests, and for prosecutors to carry those cases forward. At the same time, there were a number of high-profile cases of women fighting back against their own partners. And the way that the anti-violence movement squared that at the time was to say, the failure of police and prosecutors to intervene has left these women, and at the time we were only talking about cis women, with no other choice. And their actions in self-defense could be understood as a function of or a product of law enforcement's failure to intervene. The thought was that if law enforcement began to intervene more strongly, that people wouldn't need to take action in self-defense because they would have the protection that they needed.
Subsequent to that time, various laws were put in place, urged on by people who identified as feminist and were part of a movement of confronting violence. And this is obviously skipping over quite a bit of time, but one of the key moments was the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, which was part of the 1994 Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act. Can you tell us about what that did and who supported it? You know, how did it come to pass and the effects, the afterlife of this act?
By the late 70s and early 80s, states across the country were beginning to pass what are called mandatory arrest laws. And mandatory arrest laws require police to make an arrest in a case involving intimate partner violence whenever they had probable cause to do so. Not surprisingly, following the passage of mandatory arrest laws, arrest rates in cases of intimate partner violence increased. Prosecutions, though, didn't increase, and so anti-violence feminists turned their attention to prosecutor's office to ask why, despite the fact that there were now increased numbers of people coming into the system through arrest, prosecution wasn't increasing. And that ultimately led to a policy innovation called no-drop prosecution, where prosecutors went forward with cases regardless of whether a person subjected to abuse wanted to participate in that prosecution or not, which was what prosecutors said had been keeping them from being able to bring these cases forward. And I give you that history because that's what gets us to VAWA in 1994, that mandatory arrest laws were in place in a number of jurisdictions around the country and arrest rates were increasing, that prosecutors had adopted these policies. And the feminist anti-violence community worked with then Senator Joe Biden's office, who was looking for what he called something for women for the crime bill, to craft the Violence Against Women Act, which was originally created prior to the 1994 bill, but first enacted in 1994. And VAWA saw a very interesting coalition of people come together. Anti-violence feminists partnered with law and order conservatives to bring this bill into being as part of, as you said, the crime bill, because there were ideas around which they could both coalesce, that law enforcement had a much richer role to play in the prosecution of intimate partner violence, and that we needed to create incentives for law enforcement to do that job. VAWA is primarily a funding bill, and what it primarily funds is the criminal legal system. As of 2013, and that's the last analysis of the bill that we have, about 85% of VAWA funding was going into the criminal legal system in one way or another, and primarily into courts and police officers and prosecutors to do the business of criminalization. Early versions of VAWA also required that jurisdictions that received funding under VAWA have mandatory arrest laws. So pushing this idea that criminalization and increased intervention by police and prosecutors would be the answer to intimate partner violence. So left-wing anti-violence feminists may not have agreed with many of the people who championed the original iteration of VAWA on anything else, but this was a place where they could come together.
How has the way that prosecutions of women who have defended themselves against the violence of their partners or people trying to rape them changed over this span of time culturally or in the assumptions that are embedded in how the legal system works? I mean, you've talked about how the law changed, but at the same time, culturally, was there a shift in how the victims of violence were viewed, especially around questions of intimate partner violence, when someone ends up, say, killing their partner who has been abusing them? In some cases, the response might be, well, why did this person stay in this relationship in the first place? There's much more latitude to get out. Can you talk about those sorts of shifts over the last 40 years?
The creation and implementation of both civil laws and criminal laws meant to increase prosecution of that violence created expectations that victims of violence would simply leave their relationships, that now that there were legal tools for them to do so, that they could safely leave. That's not true. There's all kinds of research about the difficulties of leaving a violent relationship, and that's setting aside people who don't want to leave their relationships at all. But this expectation then had an impact on the way that the actions of women who acted in self-defense were viewed. So it made it easier to look at someone to say, well, you could have left. You could have gotten a protective order. You could have called the police. You could have gone to a anti-violence program. There were all kinds of things that you could and should have done to protect yourself. Part of what's happening here, though, has to do with the stereotyping of victims of violence, and that has actually changed very little. For victims of violence to be legible as victims, they have to conform to some pretty narrow stereotypes. And one of the things that struck me as I was working on imperfect victims was how little those stereotypes have changed over time. Those stereotypes were in part created by early psychological research by Dr. Lenore Walker, who coined the term battered woman syndrome and started a legal revolution in how people subjected to abuse were seen by the courts. In battered woman syndrome, Dr. Walker describes victims of violence as meek and weak and passive. She uses the psychological theory of learned helplessness, a theory that was first tested on dogs who were whipped in a lab environment, to describe how women who've been subjected to abuse learn over time that their responses to their partners are not going to lead them to safety, and so become completely powerless in the face of that violence until, ironically, the moment when they snap to take action against their partners. The stereotypes of victims of violence require you to be passive and not angry and not strong and not to fight back, and certainly not to be a substance user, not to have mental health issues. And those narrow stereotypes have been with us from that time that we were talking about in kind of the 70s and 80s and continue to now, which is part of what's so disheartening about looking at the legal system's response to people subjected to abuse or other forms of gender-based violence who then are convicted of crimes related to that violence.
So are there difference in sort of outcomes if the victim of violence looks like a worthy victim of violence versus an unworthy victim?
That's exactly right. And that's why the book is called Imperfect Victims. There's a perfect victim stereotype, and not to be repetitive, meek, weak, passive, yes, but also white and cisgender and heterosexual and a respectable woman. And if you don't conform to those particular stereotypes, you will be deemed an imperfect victim in some way, and therefore less credible and less deserving of assistance. And it's interesting to look at, for example, the victims who come closest to those stereotypes. I write about Nikki Adamando in New York, who people thought would be the perfect victim to test out a new law in New York that allows judges to decrease sentences for people whose crimes are directly related to their own victimization. She was young, is pretty, is white, was very passive in the face of much of the violence that was done to her. And still, that was not enough to get her read as a perfect victim, somebody who was deserving of assistance and of ability.
Lee Goodmark is my guest. She is Marjorie Cook Professor of Law at the University of Maryland, Carey School of Law. We're talking about her book, Imperfect Victims, Criminalized Survivors and the Promise of Abolition Feminism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in your book, you trace criminalized survivors through the process of being caught up in the legal system from beginning to end. And in fact, you start with people at the beginning of the process for many, which is young people. And I wanted to ask you why there has been an increase in the number of girls and transgender, gender nonconforming youth that have been brought into the criminal justice system related to this issue of criminalized survivors.
One reason for the greater involvement of children in the criminal legal system is the existence of mandatory arrest laws. So I told you the first part of the mandatory arrest law story, which was that jurisdictions in response to police inaction passed these laws and arrest rates went up. They went up actually for women and for girls more than anyone else. And so mandatory arrest laws have been directly tied to the increased criminalization of girls for taking defensive action against their parents or against romantic partners.
Can you explain for listeners who may not know what they are, how these mandatory arrest laws actually function?
When police come to the scene of an incident involving domestic violence, and I say domestic violence, which is a broader category than intimate partner violence and may also include elder abuse or family violence or child abuse. When police come to the scene of an incident of domestic violence and they have probable cause to believe that an incident of domestic violence has occurred, mandatory arrest laws require them to make an arrest, whether the victim wants it or not. Regardless of other kinds of mitigating circumstances, like, say, the age of the person involved. And so police are deprived of discretion. The idea was that police were using their discretion to refrain from making arrests, and taking that discretion away from them was necessary to get them to intervene. So imagine a scenario in which a young woman has been hit or threatened by a parent and fights back. And police come to the scene, and what they see is a parent who has this child, but also other children, and is making a claim that the child was violent. And they have a child who may be angry, who may be emotional, saying, "It's not true, she hit me first." And they have a decision to make about whether they remove the other parent, who then you have to figure out what you do with those other kids, or whether they remove the child, who may look less credible to them again because of that emotion, because of other factors. And they make that arrest in that moment. In a number of jurisdictions, they've moved from mandatory arrest to what's called preferred arrest. You should make an arrest whenever you have probable cause to do so, but it gives police a little more discretion. Even in those jurisdictions, though, we see increased rates of arrests of women and of girls.
And before I asked you about how these laws work, you were explaining how these laws then add to the increased involvement of young people in the criminal justice system. Is this part of a larger trend, and how significant would you say is the aspect of domestic violence and criminalized victims in that trend?
Mandatory arrest is only one part of the story. It's an important part of the story, and important enough that the Department of Justice's Office on Violence Against Women has convened proceedings to talk about the problem of mandatory arresting girls. But there are other ways that criminalized youth come into the system as well. Trafficking is actually a huge source of criminalized youth coming into the system. And that is because there are other incentives for police and prosecutors to intervene other than the belief that someone has committed a crime and needs punishment. So sometimes police and prosecutors intervene with children, youth that they believe to have been trafficked because they want to save them. And they believe that bringing them into the criminal legal system is the way to do that work. Or because they want them to testify against their traffickers, and holding them in the criminal legal system is the only way to make that happen. So there are a variety of ways that kids are coming into the system, depending upon what has happened to them, that the survivor part of criminalized survivor before they are criminalized. Similarly, young people who make rape allegations sometimes become criminalized because they are deemed not credible, and police and prosecutors then pursue them for perjury or making false statements, because they deem those claims not to be credible, even when those claims are later borne out by more evidence.
What are the longer-term effects of arresting and detaining children in this way?
There is nothing good about arresting and detaining children. Arrest has any number of consequences for kids, and it's important to remember that the vast majority of these kids are coming into the system with trauma of various kinds. They've been subjected to sexual abuse, to physical abuse and neglect, to intimate partner violence, they've been trafficked, and they come into a system that is a trauma-inducing system. We have this naive belief that detention centers for children can't possibly be as terrible as prisons are, but they are in fact as terrible as prisons for adults are in many ways. Breesha Meadows, who was 14 when she shot her father, who had been abusing her mother and also raping Breesha since she was very young, was put into a detention center and said, "This is triggering for me because this is exactly what I came from. This is what life was like in my father's home." And if you look at pictures of detention facilities or read accounts of detention facilities, you read about children being forced to stand in particular places behind lines, to not move, having absolutely substandard health care, fights that are happening, correctional officers who are not trained in any way to deal with the trauma that these kids have experienced. All of that causes re-victimization of these children. So the idea that we're bringing these children into the system to save them or to protect them in some way is just laughable.
Can you take us through the process of criminalizing victims of gender-based violence, starting with the moment of arrest and that process?
There are really three ways that victims of gender-based violence come into the criminal legal system. Some come in when they are seeking relief from their own victimization. Some come in when they are witnesses in a criminal action. And some come in as criminal defendants. And how that plays out for people varies depending upon how you come into the system. So for people who come in as victims, for example, in the book, I talk about a woman who went to get a domestic violence protective order, a civil remedy meant to protect her from the person who was abusing her. And when she was told that she was not eligible for that order, she became upset and she slapped a sign on the wall. The magistrate then incarcerated her for 5 days for her belligerence. A couple of years later, the same woman came back to that same court to seek a protective order and was told that she had arrived too late in the day to get one. The same magistrate heard her in the hallway, left his courtroom, took her forcibly back to his courtroom, and incarcerated her for 10 days, again, for belligerence. So victims come into the system and they are punished. People come into the system as witnesses, and oftentimes prosecutors use something called a material witness warrant to bring victims into the system as witnesses. Victims don't always want to testify against their partners. That was the case for Renata Singleton, who had been in a relationship with a man who broke her cell phone. And police were called. She told police she was not interested in participating in prosecution. She had a new job. She had kids. She didn't have the time to deal with it. To make a very long story short, the prosecutor's office then subpoenaed her to testify. And when she said that she was not going to testify, issued what's called a material witness warrant, asking the court to hold her in prison, to incarcerate her until such time as she testified. Ms. Singleton was incarcerated for 5 days. She was not taken before a magistrate for those 5 days. Bond was set at $100,000, which she could not possibly pay. After 5 days, she was brought back into court. She was in an orange jumpsuit, like everyone else in that courtroom. She was handcuffed and shackled and chained to the other people in that courtroom. She was eventually released on electronic monitoring. At the same time, the man against whom she did not want to testify had made his much smaller bond, had bonded out the day he was arrested, and the charges against him were ultimately settled, so they never needed Ms. Singleton to testify. People can be held on material witness warrants for a day, a week, a month, 6 months, whatever time is deemed necessary to secure their assistance with prosecution. And that's an incredibly traumatic experience, particularly when you're incarcerated in the same place as the person who you're supposed to be testifying against. And then victims come into the system as defendants. So you're called as a police officer to a scene of a case of intimate partner violence, and you're confronted with one person who is very calm, cool, and collected and describes to you what has happened and shows you, for example, that they have scratch marks on their neck. And another person who is emotional and angry and crying and says, yes, I absolutely did scratch because they were grabbing me, because they were strangling me, but has no visible injuries. Confronted with that situation, police will often take the person with the visible injuries as the victim and bring the other person into custody, regardless of the history of victimization, regardless of the context within which this happened, and that person is arrested. They can be held and they can be held without bond. They can be held until such time as trial happens. And the consequences of arrest are really severe for victims of violence. When you are arrested, you can lose your job, you can lose your housing, you can lose custody of your children. The family policing system may step in to take custody of your children if there's nowhere else for them to go. There's trauma involved in being arrested. Victims describe kind of that feeling of being handcuffed. And what that meant for them as victims who had already experienced trauma. In the book, I talk about a woman named Simone Phoenix who came to a police station in Providence to ask for housing assistance because there were anti-violence advocates housed in that system. And when she went to leave, was detained by police officers. She told the police that she was a victim of post-traumatic stress disorder and asked them not to touch her, which of course they did anyway. And so she swung out at them. They cuffed her so hard that the fire department had to take the jammed handcuffs off her hours and hours later when police finally both arrested her and then took her to the hospital. So that's what the experience of arrest is like. We have this misconception that arrest is not a violent experience, but in fact, survivors of violence experience it as amazingly violent, as amazingly traumatic, and re-traumatizing. Then once someone is arrested, oftentimes, though not always, prosecution follows. And prosecution is, of course, its own set of traumas.
Well, and before we get there, so I wanted to ask you, can incarceration ever take people out of victimizing situations, as some prosecutors argue?
It's certainly true that being locked away from the person who is abusing you takes you out of a abusive situation. And there are victims of violence who will tell you, I am safer here than I was on the outside. I think the question we have to ask ourselves as a society is that how we want to keep people who've been subjected to abuse safer, knowing that prisons and jails are trauma-inflicting institutions? That when you are in a prison or in a jail, whether you've been victimized or not, you're going to be strip searched. When you are in a prison or a jail, whether you were victimized or not, you're going to be locked away. You're going to get substandard medical care. You're going to endure abuse inflicted by correctional officers. And so while it may be true that for some people, being arrested, being incarcerated keeps them out of that violent situation or keeps them safe temporarily, it simply cannot be that this is the best way as a society that we can come up with to make that happen.
Indeed. I should say I'm speaking with Lee Goodmark about her book, Imperfect Victims, Criminalized Survivors and the Promise of Abolition Feminism. I've spoken to her earlier about her last book, Decriminalizing Domestic Partner Violence. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Lee Goodmark is director of the Gender Violence Clinic at the University of Maryland School of Law. So you've been describing the process by which survivors of violence become caught up in the criminal legal system, often criminalize themselves. And I wanted to ask you about the next step beyond arrests. What are the fortunes of people in this sort of situation when they get to the level of prosecution?
It's important to understand how much power prosecutors have in the criminal legal system. Prosecutors decide who's going to be charged, what they're going to be charged with, whether they will allow bail or seek bail, whether there will be a plea deal. Sometimes prosecutors can predetermine sentences by the charges that they inflict because mandatory minimum sentences are carried for a number of different kinds of charges. If prosecutors choose those charges, the sentence will be that mandatory minimum sentence. Prosecutors have input into sentencing. Prosecutors have input into parole. It is astounding how much power that they have. And once a criminalized survivor becomes a defendant in a criminal case, it is as though a switch flips for the prosecutor. And that prosecutor, who may spend a lot of time declaring themselves to be the voice of victims, cannot see that person as a victim any longer. We see it all the time where prosecutors will take claims of victimization and find ways to explain them away. The person says they're a victim, but in fact, they're too angry to be a victim. They're too strong to be a victim. They're not credible because they're trans and trans people are inherently incredible. They're not credible because they're a substance user. They're not credible because they have mental health issues. The history of violence is minimal. The person was just as violent as their partner, even when the evidence says exactly the opposite. And so prosecutors find ways to justify for themselves pursuing charges against criminalized survivors. And in some ways, the law facilitates that. So it's important to note, criminalized survivors come into the system in a variety of different ways. And the stereotypical way is the victim of intimate partner violence who is defending themselves against their partner in self-defense. But criminalized survivors come into the system because they've committed crimes under duress from their intimate partners, because they've been coerced by their intimate partners or others, because they've been trafficked and have committed crimes related to their own trafficking. And so it's a much broader spectrum of behaviors than just self-defense. But there are aspects of the law that make it uniquely difficult for people to even bring the defenses that they do have. So, for example, many times people will argue self-defense, but there are things inherent to self-defense law that make that difficult. And prosecutors take advantage of those difficulties to argue that someone is not really a victim. One way that the legal system was intended to deal with that problem was through the introduction of what's called battered woman or battered spouse syndrome in some places, and really is about someone's ability to introduce evidence about the history of victimization to help to explain the context within which their crimes occurred. Prosecutors love battered spouse syndrome or evidence of domestic violence when they can use it to explain why, for example, the victim in a case might be recanting an earlier statement. But as soon as someone who is a criminal defendant makes an allegation that there was a history of intimate partner violence, it is amazing how many different excuses and justifications prosecutors can come up with to discount or explain away that violence. I think one really recent example in the Netflix show Killer Sally, which some people may have watched, Sally McNeil made a claim of self-defense against her husband. But Sally McNeil was a Marine and a bodybuilder and someone who sold access to her body in wrestling matches to men who fetishized that and had a foul mouth and was argumentative. And the prosecutor in that case said very clearly, she can't be a victim because she's a violent person. So even though there were witnesses to violence, even though there were photographs of that violence, even though her daughter heard her being strangled on the night that she killed her husband, none of that was sufficient to overcome the stereotypes that this prosecutor was willing to deploy to explain away her victimization.
So in other words, she wasn't a worthy victim in that case. Say a bit more, if you will, about other cases beyond people who are fighting back against their intimate partners, situations where people become involved in criminal activity along with a partner who is abusing them, and where that dynamic is highly coercive. Can you talk about those sorts of situations? And it sounds like you're saying that in very few cases is the context of being involved in a violent relationship taken into account, or something similar related to violence taken into account in looking at the situation of that person.
I can give you two great examples from my own clients. One of my clients was involved with a man who was a drug dealer and who committed a crime in her apartment. He killed a person who came into the apartment and hid the body. She didn't know that. She was at work. Later that night, they were in bed together. He was lying with his arm around her neck, and he had been abusive to her in the past. And he said to her, "Do you think I could kill someone?" And she knew very well that he could. And she said, "Yes." And he disclosed to her that he had, in fact, killed this person in her apartment, made her clean up the blood that he had spilled all over her apartment, and then told her that if she told anyone, he would kill her and he would kill her children. He was arrested a few days later. And as soon as he was arrested, she went to the police and said, "Here's where I cleaned up. Here's where the murder weapon is. Here's how he described the crime to me." She cooperated fully with police. And the police had no reason to charge her and didn't charge her. 5 months later, they were able to flip, the prosecutor was able to flip the person who had actually helped the man to commit the crime, who said that she was involved, and they prosecuted her for that crime. She served 31 years in prison for her role in that crime, despite the fact that at the earliest safe opportunity, she had gone to police and given them all of the information they needed to prosecute the person who had actually killed the woman who'd come to the apartment. I have a client now who's incarcerated in Michigan, and she was living on the streets until she met a man who said that he would share his apartment with her. What she didn't know was that he planned to traffic her. And when she found that out, she declined to have him do that, and lived in constant fear of his violence. But because she didn't want to go back out onto the streets, she thought she would stay there until she could save enough money to get out and get a place of her own. During the time that she was there, another man came into the apartment. The man that she was living with killed that man. Hit that man, and then ordered her to tape the man's nose and mouth. She screamed. She said, "Absolutely not." He then grabbed her by the throat and pushed her up against the drywall so hard that he cracked the drywall, pulled a gun on her and said, "Get up or lay down," which she understood to mean, "You do what I asked you to do, or I'm going to kill you." And I've confirmed with him through an affidavit that that is in fact what he meant, that if she had not done this, he would have killed her. And so she did tape his mouth and tape his nose, and he, of course, later died. She was the case went cold for 7 years, and it wasn't until she went to police to say, "I feel the need to come clean about this. I want the family to have closure. I want you to be able to prosecute him for this," that a prosecution went forward. And she participated in prosecution. She testified against him, and she's currently serving at least a 20-year sentence in a Michigan prison because duress is not a defense to homicide. And so she could not use that context to explain why she did what she did.
Criminalized survivors face many things as you've been describing, and sex trafficking is one thread that runs through some of these stories. Can you explain the circumstances in which survivors are required to then register as sex offenders?
We represent a number of criminalized survivors of sex trafficking who were convicted of crimes related to their own trafficking. For example, they were working alongside young women under traffickers that they did not know to be minors. They held money for those women. They helped those women get dates. They tried to help those women do the work safely so that they would not be hurt. And when they were prosecuted, when their traffickers were prosecuted, they were prosecuted alongside of those traffickers. At least one of my clients was trafficked by her intimate partner who was abusive, and the victims in that case all testified to seeing how her partner had abused her to such an extent that they all acknowledged that she could not possibly have gotten away from him. Nonetheless, once you have been convicted of sex trafficking, you are required to register as a sex offender. And the impact of registration as a sex offender is enormous. It has an impact on everything you do. One client of the Human Trafficking Clemency Initiative, which is a kind of a coalition that I'm part of, after she was required to register, was told by her parole officer not to go to her child's softball games, not to put out Halloween candy, not to participate in school events. Your information is publicly known in many places because there are public sex offender registries. So all of the information about your whereabouts, and depending on where you live, it can be as detailed or granular as what kind of car you're driving and your actual street address, are made available to the public. So the stigma of having to register as a sex offender, having been trafficked yourself, having experienced trauma yourself, adds injury to injury, not insult to injury.
I'm speaking with Lee Goodmark about Imperfect Victims, Criminalized Survivors, and the Promise of Abolition Feminism, that is published by the University of California Press. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Lee Goodmark is professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. You've described the kind of challenges that occur for criminalized survivors of violence on all sorts of levels within the criminal legal system. What about resentencing and parole? What sorts of difficulties do they encounter at that level?
There are a couple of states that have attempted to take intimate partner violence and other forms of violence into consideration at resentencing, kind of post-sentencing remedies. The problem, though, that some people have in utilizing those remedies is the same problem that they have on the front end, which is that they're deemed not credible. So their failure to conform to these kind of strict ideas of victimization keep them from being credible post-sentencing in the same way that they were not deemed credible pre-sentencing. And in the context of parole, it's actually much more complicated because parole is all about remorse. And what parole commissions want to see from you is remorse and rehabilitation. For many criminalized survivors, the actions that they took saved their lives. So while they're certainly remorseful, and I don't have a single client who doesn't hate the fact that someone was hurt or killed in the context of their crimes, they also accept that had they not done what they did, it would be them who had died or had been severely injured or harmed rather than their partners. And conveying that to a parole commission that is conditioned to hear, "I did something wrong. I accept that I did something wrong." I don't, it kind of that moral, unequivocal acceptance of wrongdoing is difficult. What we try to do is explain to parole commissioners and others that violence is not an excuse for the person's behavior, but it is an explanation, and it's an important part of understanding the context and understanding why this person will not be a threat to society going forward. But parole commissioners, judges, and others who look at these cases post-sentencing have varying amounts of willingness to consider that context. And when their actions are divorced from context, it makes it look as though they're not remorseful at all.
And then it goes to a question which, you know, in many ways goes back to the beginning of this conversation, that came to the fore in the 1970s around a number of cases where women fought back against their attackers, which is, you know, is the state the only entity that should respond to rape or violence? Do victims have the right to fight back in self-defense? How do you think about those questions?
In my book, Decriminalizing Domestic Violence, I make the argument that, in fact, the state is probably the worst way to intervene in cases of intimate partner violence, that it's not having the impact that we want it to have, and that we should be looking at a number of other ways to intervene, including through economic remedies, through public health prevention, and through community-based interventions. The criminal legal system is not doing the work that people think that it is doing, either to protect victims or to quote unquote rehabilitate people who don't need rehabilitation. And so there are so many other ways that we could be doing this work. The argument that I make in this book about criminalized survivors is that abolition feminism needs to be the politics and practice that we use to understand how we move forward in this space. And there's really interesting work going on around criminalized survivors in the community. So if you look back to the 1970s in the case of Joanne Little, there was a broad anti-violence feminist coalition arguing that Joanne Little should not be prosecuted for the killing of a correctional officer who tried to rape her. She was incarcerated at the time. The correctional officer tried to rape her, and she stabbed him with the ice pick that he had brought in to threaten her with. We see similar kinds of defense organizing going on now, and there's amazing work going on that started around Brisha Meadows and Marissa Alexander that continues around Nikki Adamondo and Wendy Howard and Madison George and other criminalized survivors to help communities understand why the criminal legal intervention here is the wrong way to address these cases. And I think it's important to note, and I'm sorry that we haven't done it sooner, that it's the work of feminists of color, and particularly Black feminists, that guides our thinking and our actions in these areas. And we owe a huge debt to people like Beth Ritchie and Alyssa Bieria and Andrea Ritchie and Dr. Angela Davis and Miriam Kaba, who have really led the way in helping us think about how we can intervene as communities on behalf of these people to try to divert them out of the criminal legal system.
Well, let's talk more about that. And what would it look like? I mean, on the one hand, I think there's a broad acknowledgement, at least amongst progressives, and in fact, it extends to other parts of U.S. society, that there is a problem with mass incarceration, and so efforts to decrease it, at the very least. And then there's simultaneously the impulse to take gender-based violence seriously, especially given the history of gender-based violence not being taken seriously in this country. You argue, and you are arguing, that we shouldn't see these as polar opposites, but I wonder if you could talk in more detail how those two could be achieved.
The reason that we see those things as being in conflict is because we believe, we have been led to believe, that intervention by the criminal legal system does something about gender-based violence, does something constructive, decreases that violence, deters that violence. And I have argued in lots of places that that's simply not true and that the data doesn't support that. So for progressives, that tension very much exists, the desire to do that gender-based violence versus the real concern about mass incarceration. Breaking down this wrong idea that incarceration, that criminalization is a positive benefit to dealing with gender-based violence is the way to help harmonize those two claims. In fact, criminalization exacerbates many of the correlates of the perpetration of intimate partner violence, including the experience of trauma, including economic distress, including community dysfunction. And so through criminalizing, we're actually creating conditions in which intimate partner violence and other forms of gender-based violence happens, not mitigating those conditions. So that's the first step, is understanding that criminalization is not doing the work that we want it to do. And once that you understand that, it's much easier then to start to think about the things that we need to do to dismantle the criminal legal system and to put the overwhelming amount of resources, $180 billion a year going into police and prisons in the United States, into the things that will actually prevent violence and allow everybody to have what they need to thrive.
Getting rid of the existing system is certainly a massive task. And what sort of changes could be made to try and address and prevent violence at the same time shrinking and reducing this whole system of mass incarceration at the same time? You know, you are talking about all the problems with the current system, and presumably efforts to do piecemeal reforms to it are going to therefore be pretty ineffective. But what can be done in the sort of short and medium term to address it, even for those who would like to abolish it entirely?
Specifically in the context of criminalized survivors, for people who aren't quite ready to go all the way to abolition, there are any number of things that we can do to decrease the impact of this system on criminalized survivors. We can get rid of the material witness warrant laws that I described earlier that allow prosecutors to ask for the incarceration of victims of violence pending the trials that they don't necessarily want to participate in. We can get rid of mandatory arrest laws, which have increased arrests of women, and particularly women of color, more than any other group. We can get rid of mandatory sentencing laws that doom criminalized survivors to long sentences when prosecutors decide to charge them with crimes that carry those mandatory minimums. We can reform parole so that the nature of the crime isn't the overriding concern of parole commissioners, and rather whether someone is continuing to be a danger, whether they ever were a danger to society, is the thing that they look at. We can push governors to use their clemency powers on behalf of criminalized survivors. Something that Survived and Punished in New York has been doing really kind of effectively, and I think a model for many of us to follow. We can provide survivors with defense campaigns of the kind that we saw for Marissa Alexander and Breisha Meadows. In fact, in New York very recently, the Survivor Defense Campaign for Tracy McCarter, I think, is directly responsible for the fact that the current district attorney, Alvin Bragg, finally dropped after 2 years the charges against Ms. McCarter, whose husband was killed while she defended herself from his violence. We can invest in the things that people need to thrive, and this is something that I've written about a lot. We can decrease economic inequality and ensure that men particularly have good paying employment. Male under and unemployment is the single most significant correlate of intimate partner violence. We can invest upstream in prevention. There's so much good data about how we could be preventing intimate partner violence, starting with interventions when children are very, very young, to prevent adverse childhood experiences from happening, going through education as adolescents, rethinking how we do intervention with those who have used violence, and thinking about system level, societal level interventions around things like guns, which is less likely, and alcohol, which may in fact be more likely. So there's so much that we can do short of abolition for people who are not quite ready to go there. But ultimately, as long as actors within the criminal legal system are vested with the discretion to determine that someone belongs in that system, criminalized survivors are going to be punished. Police and prosecutors and judges will find ways to justify putting people in that system in the first instance. Parole commissioners and governors and presidents will find ways to justify keeping them there after they've been sent there. It's that discretion that's vested in criminal system actors that enables them to go after criminalized survivors while at the same time saying that they are the voice of victims. So as long as that system exists, it's going to punish people, and criminalized survivors are going to end up in it.
Where would you point people who are interested in supporting the kind of work of supporting the criminalized victims of violence that you and your students have been engaged in, and there are many other efforts around the country to help support people who are incarcerated for defending themselves? What would you suggest people do if they wanted to support that kind of work?
In some communities, there are organizations that exist to do that work. The California Coalition for Women Prisoners has been doing it amazingly for many, many years. Survived and Punished does it. Muavi in Chicago does it. Love and Protect does it. So in your community, there may be organizations doing that work. It may be that you know of a criminalized survivor who needs help. Form your own survivor defense campaign. There are resources online, amazing resources that are available. And folks who've been engaged in those campaigns are incredibly generous with their time. You can support the organizations like mine, my clinic and other clinics around the country that are doing this work, the Philly Justice Project, the Illinois Prison Project. There are lawyers working with criminalized survivors all over the country. And if you're interested in sending copies of Imperfect Victims into criminalized survivors who are incarcerated, I am currently running a GoFundMe to send those books into prison. We have requests for about 600 books, and it would be great to have that help.
Lee Goodmark, thank you so much for coming back on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Lee Goodmark is Marjorie Cook Professor of Law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, where she runs the Gender Violence Clinic. She's the author of Imperfect Victims, Criminalized Survivors, and the Promise of Abolition Feminism, published by UC Press. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.